Good morning and welcome to the Ninth Circuit. We are pleased to have Judge Whaley of the Eastern District of Washington, who is appearing as a visiting judge and by video. We hope we will be done with the video by next month, maybe, or the month after. But Judge Watford and I are glad to be here in person. We will hear today Cohn versus Gambia, which we heard the first time a couple years ago. And we will begin with Ms. Hine. Yes? Hello?
I'm sorry, Judge Berzon, I missed the last part that you just said.
I guess the
state. Actually, we will begin with Mr. Beasley because this is a DOJ appeal, so that was wrong. Go ahead, Mr. Beasley.
Thank you, Judge Berzon, and may it please the court, Christopher Beasley, Deputy Attorney General, on behalf of the respondent in this case, and I guess appellant in this case. As Judge Berzon noted, this court heard the appeal the first time, and it noted on that appeal that there was an evidentiary deficiency in the record, specifically as to what happened in the parking lot at the time of arrest. And therefore, the court remanded the matter for an evidentiary hearing to resolve that evidentiary question as to what had happened in the parking lot. That factual resolution, that factual question was resolved in the district court in the state's favor, and yet the state lost. And so that's what's kind of problematic in this case. That's what's strange. How did the state lose on a claim that had we litigated that throughout all the litigation had been clear, and then all of a sudden the claim changed in the district court? And so as I pointed out,
at the original oral argument there was discussion of the right to silence issue, wasn't there?
Very tangential. It was never a developed argument. There was never any real development as to the law the legal underpinnings for the right to silence.
Law's not different. I mean, there's no different law, specifically and expressly there isn't.
So the right to silence and the right to counsel are different analytically, and how they are actually approached, they're different.
Why are they approached differently? In what way?
So, for example, when a person invokes the right to silence, that cuts off questioning, just as when a person invokes the right to counsel. However, with the right to silence, police can come back a day or two later, reinitiate contact, re-warn the suspect of the Miranda warnings, and the person can waive and then continue to talk. With the right to counsel,
the same interrogation, they can just keep him there and then ask him again to speak. Do you have a case of saying that?
That's the law.
I thought it at a later time, yes, but in the same place at the same time.
No, that's what I'm saying. It's like a day later, a day or two later.
Well, that wasn't what you were saying. You were saying it was in the same place.
No, that's not what I said. I may have misspoken, but that's not what I said. I said that a police officer, if the person invokes the right to silence, and at that point, questioning stops. But then a couple of days later, the
nothing
police
to do with
back.
This case, right? Because it wasn't a second time in a second place. So, as it applies to this case, what is the differing law?
Well, just because the United States Supreme Court has said that they are different rights, and that the invocation of one does not assert the invocation of the other, and so analytically they're different. They are different rights. They're governed by different standards, and so that's what makes it different. And so when you have a litigant here presenting to the California Supreme Court that his right to counsel has been violated and repeatedly asserts that that's the right, then the question that has to arise is, how does that exhaust the right to counsel, the right to silence? He never raised that.
Exhaustion, I mean, you specific, as I understand what went on here with exhaustion was, the exhaustion rights and the procedural default rights merge into each other at some point if the issue could not have been re-raised in the state court, right? And here the state court, and you, in the last appeal, out of the district court, said there was no right procedural default issue, and there was no exhaustion. So why are we going back to the exhaustion question?
No, we never expressly waived exhaustion.
Exhaustion.
No, we never expressly waived exhaustion because we never had anything to talk about in terms of exhaustion. The only thing that we were willing to waive, that we didn't bring it up, was the procedural bars that the Superior Court had imposed. The Superior Court had erroneously imposed the procedural bar that the claims that were raised in the petition had not, should have been raised on direct appeal, and then a second procedural bar when he filed a second petition in the Superior Court, that it was a successive petition. Those were the procedural bars. We did not assert them at all in the district court because we wanted the district court to conclude that the Supreme Court's denial of the claims was on the merits. It was ridiculous that the Superior Court had imposed those procedural bars. It was absolutely a mistake. It was an obvious mistake. And so our argument was that those procedural bars wouldn't have the Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court would not have recognized those procedural bars because they were obviously ridiculously imposed by the trial court erroneously. And so we tried to get the district court to make a ruling on the merits. That's why we waived the procedural bars, didn't bring them up at all. But we never talked about exhaustion because exhaustion was not something that was on the table, because there was nothing to talk about. There was never any sort of, the only time exhaustion became an issue was when the district court on remand went south or went sideways on us and started to grant relief, did grant relief on a right to silence claim that had never been litigated, had never been presented to the state courts, was never at play anywhere in the proceedings. That's when we asserted and said, this is an unexhausted claim, district court. You cannot grant relief on this claim. At no point prior to that point did we need to talk about exhaustion. So there was never an opportunity to expressly waive exhaustion. So no, we, the state, did not ever expressly waive exhaustion. Now, is it fair to the Supreme Court to say, yeah, this guy has, he's argued the right to counsel claim over and over and over. Is it fair to the Supreme Court of California to say, oh, you should have also seen in that and divined there a right to silence claim, when the district court, the magistrate judge, the federal public defender, none of those people saw a right to silence
claim? That part is not true. The federal public defender did argue the right to silence. Well, not the federal defender. The there was mention of the right to silence in the district, in the magistrate judge's opinion, originally.
In passing, yes, you're right.
What does in passing have to do with that?
That's an important point. If there's no analysis, it's just a passing reference that says right to counsel, right to silence, without any analysis as to what's going on. That matters.
And of course, at that point, the problem is that the transcript that the government had produced didn't have the sentence in it. It wasn't there. Right?
And so, I don't understand the question.
The transcript that the government was operating on at the time of the original district court proceedings, the key sentence on the right to silence was not in the transcript. It was dot, dot, dot.
That's correct.
Right.
And so there was a separate transcript.
And there was a separate transcript. So there was a debate about the transcript. So the government was not even acknowledging that this was said, but it clearly was said.
That's correct that it was said. But just because it was said doesn't mean that Kahn was actually arguing that it was an invocation of the right to silence. He didn't invoke that right. He didn't talk about that right. He maintained throughout that he was invoking, that he had invoked the right to counsel. He focused his arguments on the right to counsel. Even in his traverse, after the government had submitted its answer, Kahn did not talk about the right to silence. He continued to argue about the right to counsel. Then when the magistrate judge came out with the report and recommendation, Kahn submitted objections to that report and recommendation. And again, nothing in the report, in the objections, as to the right to silence. Nothing to assert that he was actually invoking the right to silence and had invoked that. His focus at all times throughout all of the litigation was that he had invoked the right to counsel. That is why all of that.
Why isn't it enough, given that the petitioner here was pro se? Why wasn't it enough before the state courts that he submitted the transcript and circled and put a check mark next to the invocation of the right to silence? Why? It just seems to me, yes, if we had a lawyer here and the lawyer had emphasized the right to counsel, maybe you'd have something to talk about. But the person was pro se, and why didn't he get close enough to alerting the California Supreme Court to what
Because
to
even
a
pro se litigant is required to provide not only the factual basis for the claim. So circling that statement certainly is enough to provide the factual basis, but then tie that factual basis to a legal theory. And he didn't.
Well, he said his Miranda rights, which include the right to silence, and he cited at least one state case that discussed the right to silence. So why wasn't that
Mr. Beasley,
People versus Neal, I think.
So
Kelly?
His what?
I'm sorry, why don't you answer, and then Judge Whaley has a question, I think.
So what he did is he said, yes, the Miranda right, but he qualified it. The Miranda right to counsel, when he says the
At
Miranda
some points,
right,
but not others.
He never in his petitions said just Miranda by itself. It was always tied to the Miranda right to counsel or the Fifth Amendment right to counsel. It's repeated over and over and over. And to suggest that the California Supreme Court is supposed to divine from all of that, oh, there's lurking here a right to silence claim is unfair to the California Supreme Court. And it's clear that given the way that he then litigates it in the district court, that he wasn't even concerned about a right to silence violation. That's not what he raised.
Well, then,
it's hard to discuss things with you because you continually misstate the record. The attachment E starts evidentiary error, Miranda violation, underlined, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
And then he goes on to qualify it as he explains what that Miranda violation is.
Mr. Beasley, I'd like to ask you something. We know that the pro se litigant made a claim about what he said. If he'd used the word silence and said, as opposed to what he said about he's not going to talk anymore, is it really the substance of what he said in his circle that's got you there? Because he says, that's all I have to say. But if he said, I'm going to remain silent, as opposed to that's all I've got to say, then would you be saying, well, that's enough? And even though he didn't talk about it anymore, he just talked about Miranda in general, that nonetheless, that would have been enough? Or does he have to?
In answer to your question, Judge Whaley, I don't think that there's some sort of special words that he has to say. I think that if that statement, that's all I have to say, that statement could be enough. It could be enough. But given the context
If it could be enough, and he's pro se, and that could be enough to tell a police officer he doesn't want to talk, then it seems like the fact that he spent the rest of his time talking about the other prong of Miranda wouldn't make any difference. For some reason, I see your argument sort of conflating on he really didn't say enough. But if someone would read that and say, he said, that's all I have to say, and concluded that was invoking his right to remain silent, then he's raised it because he's circled it and he's raised Miranda.
No, I didn't. No, that I disagree with that. The circling of the statement itself gives you the factual underpinning, but I disagree with the idea that all he ever said was Miranda. Sure, he said Miranda violation, underlined it, but then he explains it. He explains it to the court. And so what the proposition that the court is suggesting here is that the Supreme Court of California is supposed to ignore his explanation of what his Miranda violation is. I agree. If he had said Miranda violation, underlined that, left it at that, said nothing more, and circled, then I have no argument. I agree with that. But that's not what happened here. Here, he says Miranda violation, explains exactly what the Miranda violation is. It's the violation of the right to counsel. I asked for a lawyer, none available. They ignored my request for a lawyer, over and over and over and over. That's what he's saying. So that's what the California Supreme Court, that's what the state courts are focused on, because that's where he focused them upon. That's what he focused the district court upon. And that's why the focus of the district court was the same. And that's why when the objections come along, he's focused on that one claim. This was not fairly and squarely presented to the California Supreme Court. It's an unexhausted claim.
Can I ask just one other question? Go ahead, Judge Whaley. Sorry.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Judge Watford. But I was going to paraphrase him because I wanted to make sure I understood. If he had not said any more than he just said Miranda, and that's all I have to say, you would say it's exhausted, because anybody reading that would have concluded I've got two issues. One is the right to counsel and one is the right to remain silent. But having gone farther in his argument about Miranda, that he somehow misled the court, and while they might have concluded that if they'd read it closely, that he had two rights, by having gone farther, the Supreme Court was misled.
I do not think the Supreme Court was misled. I think that the Supreme Court was very clearly given what his complaint was, that his right to counsel was what was violated, not the right to silence. He wasn't concerned about the right to silence. If this was a pretty sophisticated litigant in a lot of respects, given how clearly he presented his claims, but he still is pro se, and so we give him the benefit of the doubt. But the way that he articulated his claim, by focusing on the right to counsel to the exclusion of the right to silence, it's not that he's misleading the California Supreme Court. He's guiding the California Supreme Court to clearly consider what his actual complaint is. And that's why this claim is unexhausted, because he explained what his claim is without, if he had just said Miranda, left it at that, circled the two statements, then the California Supreme Court has to look at that and think, okay, one statement talks about a lawyer, one statement says I don't have anything to say, then that both of the rights of Miranda are implicated. But where he has gone so far as to explain clearly what's going on in his complaint, that puts the California Supreme Court in a different posture. I thought Judge Watford had a question, but maybe I've answered it.
No. Maybe you could just shift to the merits. Let's assume that we were not persuaded on exhaustion. You do have a merits argument. I'd love to hear your additional words on that.
Sure. I think on the merits, this is one of those cases where you have statements made by a police officer, and then the statement that the district court found, this court has the benefit of listening to the recording, the enhanced recording of what Khan said. It's not an unequivocal, unambiguous invocation of the right to silence.
I am confused. I thought you said before it was.
No, I said it could be depending on, and I didn't say this part, but it could be depending on the circumstances. And the circumstances here, it wasn't a clear and unambiguous invocation of the right to silence. Why? Because the officer had just gone through explaining who he is, noting that it's been a lot of time since the arrest, noting that Khan might have some questions, wants to talk. And then we hear some words. And the district court found that those words were so tired. That's all I have to say, you know, something to that effect. Okay. And then there's a pause as and some shuffling of papers. And then the detective then tries to explain what's going on. That creates a context where it looks like there's an ambiguity there. What is he talking about? I'm tired. That's what I've got to say. I'm tired. I'm not invoking a right to silence. I don't want to say anything more. I'm just telling you that I'm tired. That's what I have to say for right now. Those are reasonable interpretations of what his words are.
There's at least one case, isn't there, that says, I don't want to say anything else right now is enough of an invocation?
Yeah, and the difference in that case is that that defendant had been invoked. He had been advised of the Miranda rights. Khan had not yet been advised of the Miranda rights. So he had been advised. And then they're in the middle of the questioning as to the crime. Questioning and interrogation is happening. And it's at that point that defendant says, I don't have anything to say right now. I don't want to say anything right now. And that is a clear invocation of the right to silence. You've got the reference
point.
Doesn't
Miranda itself say that the invocation can be before or after the Miranda rights are read?
I didn't hear that.
I think it's Miranda, but at least one or more Supreme Court cases says that the invocation can be before or after the Miranda rights are read.
My understanding of the law is that it's actually not settled, that peremptory invocations, some courts have held that peremptory invocations are not efficacious. Other courts have held otherwise. I don't know if that matters, but what does make a difference in that case is that the defendant had been advised of the Miranda rights. So there's a reference point. He then is in the middle of interrogation as to the crime. He says, I don't want to talk anymore right now.
Miranda says, if the individual indicates in any manner at any time prior or during questioning that he wishes to remain silent, the interrogation must cease.
Yes, prior to, yeah, that's correct, as to questioning, but that doesn't mean, that's not saying as to when the advisal has been given. That says nothing about the advisal. So the defendant here, he's just simply responding to not even an interrogation question, but he's telling the officer, yeah, it's I'm tired. It's been a while since I was arrested. I've been waiting here for a while. And those are reasonable interpretations to what Khan is saying. Those reasonable interpretations give the officer the right then to resolve the ambiguity. And that's what he did. He explained the situation, read the Miranda rights, gave Khan the full opportunity to expressly state yes or no, I want to talk or not. And with
so
that, I
your,
will
your refer- time is about to run. We can give you a couple minutes in rebuttal. Is that okay?
Thank you. I appreciate that, Your Honor.
Okay. Ms. Hine.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Deputy Federal Public Defender Devin Hine, on behalf of Petitioner Appellee Kenneth Khan. The issue here is that respondent insists for the first time only after Mr. Khan has been granted relief by the district court that they have never, that they've never waived exhaustion on Mr. Khan's Miranda invocation. And respondent frames this argument by saying that the right to silence and right to counsel are somehow divided when it comes to the pleading standard applying to a pro se petitioner. None of this makes sense. I'd like to start with the idea that respondent didn't expressly waive this claim. They not only expressly addressed it, but expressly waived it in their answer. The answer states in its opening body that all of Khan's claims appear to be exhausted. And then the supporting memorandum specifically addresses the statement at issue here.
Can I ask you to walk through the chronology a little bit so I make sure I understand?
Absolutely.
Let me just frame my question to you.
Stop just a second.
the state is saying that the point you've just made is not a valid one because the only claim it understood to ever have ever been raised until after the remand from our court on the first appeal was this right to counsel claim. And so they say, but this is what I want you to correct me on, they say that the first time your client and your office ever asserted a separate violation of the right to silence was back on remand, I guess, during the evidentiary hearing, and that at that point they did say, wait a minute, if we're talking about right to silence now, that claim has not been exhausted. So they say the first time they had an opportunity to raise exhaustion was post-remand and that they did so. So maybe you can address what part of that I've gotten wrong.
Right, absolutely. So I think the issue here is that the record has been somewhat muddied as to who knew what and when, right? So we recall that Mr. Khan was unrepresented all through state habeas proceedings, but all of his petitions were identical, right? And respondent has also conceded that his petition to the district court was identical to those in the state court. So the first time that if we recall back to the purpose of pleadings in habeas, right, the petitioner initiates habeas with a petition, but it is actually the answer, the respondent's answer, that is supposed to frame the issues, in part because the petitioner as of yet has been unrepresented. So when respondent has the is answering Mr. Khan's petition and has the opportunity to address any claims they see there, they first state in the opening portion of their answer that Khan's claims appear to be expressly waived.
Well, but of course, that depends what the claims are. So if they don't know that a right to silence is being claimed, then their contention is that their exhaustion statement went to what they understood to have been raised. So you need, therefore, to explain why they should have understood. If you're depending on waiver as opposed to what was actually raised, then you need, in terms of a pro se pleading, then what matters is what they understood to have been the claim that they were saying was exhausted.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's what I was getting to next, which is if you look to the body of that pleading, the memorandum in support of the answer, when they reached this statement of Mr. Khan's, though at the time it was portrayed as, don't talk, that's all I have to say, they addressed that statement head on. And they said, First, this statement is under debate as to whether it's even been made, because Mr. Khan's transcript is different from ours. But even if the statement was made, it doesn't matter because it was made before he was Mirandized. So they have been aware of the statement for some time and addressed it head on. They didn't say so to
that,
the extent
that was in
that,
the government's. What brief is that in?
Memorandum in support of the answer, and that is in the record at 3 RT 432-34. So their answer, their very first opportunity to respond to petitioner's claims, they saw that statement. They saw that statement as some sort of invocation and therefore challenged it on both a factual and legal basis.
But is their position, though, that they understood it to be as an invocation, a supposed invocation of the right to counsel?
I mean, I would say that there, I couldn't tell one way or the other, but I think the other problem here is that respondent at all times is sort of in control of what the record looks like, and their choice not to address it at some point has to be ascribed to them. This is equally true with Mr. Khan's initial argument that he had invoked at the time of arrest, which they conveniently failed to address until Khan had counsel in this court last time. So I think it's also worth noting, right, that throughout these proceedings, it should have been respondent's burden, right, to prove that this statement was lawfully taken. That's true in the trial level, certainly. So we go through trial with respondent never having to show that Mr. Khan's statement was lawfully obtained. We go through direct appeal where Mr. Khan somehow is, this issue is somehow not raised on Mr. Khan's behalf. We get to state habeas where Mr. Khan is unrepresented and I think uses a perfectly fair colloquial representation of the theory of Miranda by calling all of Miranda the right to counsel. I think that that's how pro se petitioners walking through the world would understand Miranda, and that this designation right to silence is a legal term of art that shouldn't bind a pro se petitioner. And then when we get to the district court and it's respondent's turn to clarify the legal issues, they don't raise the issue that a right to silence wasn't particularly stated. They don't raise the fact that Khan said he asked for an attorney at the time of his arrest. So they were so focused on having this theoretical merits denial from the California Supreme Court, and strategically so, that they didn't address these specific issues with Khan's petition, and now they want to address them because the court finally noticed this claim that it overlooked before. And I want to, no one's asking any questions, sorry. I wanted to also point out that in some ways this doesn't matter, because even if Khan had not exhausted this claim, the court could address that claim if not doing so would result in manifest injustice. And that's what the court said happened here. The court said that it had overlooked in its own pleadings a claim that had it seen it, it would have
wouldn't excuse an exhaustion. I mean, if there was not a waiver, and if there was not exhaustion and there was not a waiver through the procedural default, then the district court couldn't reach it as a matter of manifest injustice, right?
Yes, they could. So, I'm sorry, I want to make sure I heard you right. You're saying that the court could.
I'm saying that the fact that the court reached it as a matter of manifest injustice would not deal with the exhaustion problem if there were one.
Oh, yes, it does. Once the question of exhaustion is raised, right, there are exceptions to the rule that a claim need to be exhausted. One is futility. The other is manifest injustice.
Really?
What's your authority for that latter proposition, especially? I don't recall there being a manifest injustice exception to the exhaustion requirement. Certainly not in AEDPA.
I'm sorry. I will. I believe I have that case in front of me, but if I do not, I can certainly provide it for you in supplemental briefing
also,
as well.
Also, the AEDPA specifically says that exhaustion has to be directly invoked.
Right, expressly waived. Not necessarily directly, but expressly waived. And five circuits have already agreed that where a respondent waives by way of stating this claim has been expressly, or when a respondent states in their answer, the claims appear to be exhausted, that is an express waiver, even where they might have been erroneous in making that waiver. So five circuits have agreed on that point, and two circuits have pointed out situations where the respondent may have erred strategically in making that waiver, but it was counted as a waiver nonetheless.
What's your response to the state's argument? Let's just turn to the merits of the exhaustion point as opposed to waiver. Mm-hmm. The state says, well, listen, if in the petition itself, Khan had just said my Miranda rights were violated and left it at that, that, you know, the state wouldn't have any argument to be made on exhaustion, but that because Khan was so explicit in directing all of the attention to the right to counsel, that the California Supreme Court could be sort of forgiven for overlooking the fact that he was separately invoking the right to silence. And then the state points to the fact that the district court itself kind of acknowledged that, well, even though I had before me the exact same transcript with the exact same circling of the invocation and a check mark next to it, the district court itself kind of missed this because nobody had, you know, had specifically drawn attention to it. So what's your response to faulting, I guess, the California Supreme Court for having missed this when the district court appears to have done so as well?
Well, I think it's important to know that what the district court said it missed was a clear error. The court didn't say that it had missed the issue because the right to silence was not specifically implicated. It said it missed it because of the number of pages attached. And considering that the reason for petitioner's level of pleading is the requirement that they produce reasonably documentary evidence to prove their claims, I would not take the district court's concession of error to be that the right to silence wasn't highlighted before, but that the court had not fully addressed the statement itself. And I also would point to, you know, I would point to the U.S. Supreme Court statement in Boeg v. McDougall, 454 U.S. 364, where it was looking at a petition that had been dismissed and said that when you construe a petitioner's claims liberally, no matter how inartfully pled, if you can see any claim for which there could be relief, you shouldn't dismiss the claim outright. And I think that's the issue here, is multiple parties have identified this claim. The respondent is basically asking us to unsee the claim and to ignore the right of pro se liberal pleading when we all see a claim that's otherwise meritorious on its face. I don't think that's the way that habeas was ever meant to operate, right? Pro se petitioners have to do their best to raise a claim. But if a court can find a claim, it would certainly, I think, be contrary to the spirit of habeas to intentionally ignore that claim because of a late raised argument about exhaustion. So I guess that's all to say that the posture we're in here is very unique, in part because of how respondents chose to address this case, right? They were, like I said, they were dogged in their argument that this was a summary merits denial, and they wanted the court to search the record high and low for reasons to deny the claim. But when the court says, my mere re-review of the exhibits alerted me to a claim I'd missed before, now they say that the court has gone too far. I just think that's not the way that the pro se habeas rules work. When a petitioner has raised the right legal standard, Miranda, it's alerted the state court to the federal nature of its claim. And as respondent has conceded, the legal basis of the claim was noted by circling the statement. The fact that all of these courts unreasonably either ignored or overlooked Mr. Khan's claim as part of the manifest injustice, that means we need to affirm the district court's ruling now.
Do you want to respond to the warden's merits argument as to whether this was an invocation of the right to silence?
Absolutely. I'd start with the concern about whether or not the statement was made before or after being Mirandized. This court held in Arnold v. Reynolds that where the petitioner's claim was before Miranda, they nonetheless granted relief. That was a pre-Miranda invocation of silence, saying he didn't want to be recorded.
What's the name of that case?
Arnold v. Reynolds. That's 421 F3rd 859. So that's a pre-Miranda case where the invocation for silence was raised before Mirandizing. I'd also say that, you know, the reason that we just reiterated the cases the district court raises, they were spot on. That's all I have to say has not been held to be ambiguous. I don't want to talk no more has not been held to be ambiguous. And the law also says that what a police officer says to a defendant after they've made their statement does not change whether the statement was ambiguous or not. I'd say that's particularly true here where, you guys asked for the recording, so I would assume you've heard it, but if you want to hear it again, I have it teed up. The officer Schilling walks Mr. Khan into the interrogation room. He introduces himself. He ingratiates himself. He says, I'm sure you have a lot of questions and you want to talk about things. And then he waits for Mr. Khan to begin to incriminate himself. When Mr. Khan instead takes the opportunity to say, I'm so tired, that's all I have to say, you know, the detective waits for, I won't say 7 seconds because there were the whole point of enhancing the record, right, was to slow it down, so I don't want to misrepresent that. But there is a pregnant pause before Detective Schilling decides what he's going to do about Mr. Khan's invocation. And what he chooses to do is speak to Mr. Khan for an additional full minute before he gets to any sort of Mirandizing. He says, let me make this easier for you. I've heard from everyone else in the case. Don't you want to tell me your side of the story? And then he Mirandizes him. Subjectively, this is evidence that the police officer understood exactly what Mr. Khan said and didn't like what he heard. But that doesn't make this statement unambiguous. Mr. Khan's statement remained unambiguously that was all he had to say. So tired, that's all I have to say. And I'd also say to give more context, I'm so sorry. I keep stopping because I think my own echo sounds like you're asking questions. But to give more context to this, I point out that while the district court ultimately found there was not enough evidence because due to Mr. Khan's lack of memory and the police officer's lack of credibility, that the parties were in equipoise, that's not the same thing as saying that Mr. Khan's first invocation, as he understood it, didn't happen at all. So for Mr. Khan, who has already tried once, as far as he's recalled, to stop this questioning from happening, he's now, you know, been held for a long time without water, without a restroom, without any questioning, and he's been dragged into this room, and he says, I've been trying to, like, get a lawyer in here for however long. I don't want to talk to you. I'm so tired.
He didn't say that. I mean, that's the problem. We tend to parse these things perhaps inappropriately, extremely closely. And it is possible that if he did say what he said he said with regard to the attorney earlier, that his statement, that's all I have to say, was essentially a restatement that says, I don't want to talk without a lawyer. I mean, the notion that these are all that separate is somewhat misleading because the right to have a lawyer is a right not to talk, to be silent until you get a lawyer. So they're clearly intertwined. And
I agree, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
That was the point I was trying to make, in a sense, is that there we do look to the context of Mr. Khan's efforts before to stop questioning, right? Whether it be I don't want to talk or I don't want to talk with a lawyer, which kind of brings us back to the beginning of this issue of whether or not these things are in fact separate issues that have to be raised by separate terms of art in a pleading, right? We can tell from Mr. Khan's conduct at this point that he doesn't want to talk, and that the police continue to attempt to get him to talk when he says he doesn't want to. And that's why the context of his statements matter. But the fact that the police want him to talk is not a fact that gives context to whether his statement was ambiguous, is the point that I'm trying to make. And if the court, I don't believe I have any other points I'd like to address directly unless the court has any other questions.
Any questions? Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Mr. Beasley, 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I really don't have anything to add other than that it's the Murray versus Carrier case, United States Supreme Court case, that says that the manifest injustice exception is reserved in terms of, like, is reserved for the extraordinary case, where a constitutional violation has probably resulted in the conviction of one who is actually innocent. So it does exist. But in the context of this kind of case, I don't think this qualifies as an extraordinary case. We're not dealing with someone who is actually innocent. And so I would suggest that exception to the exhaustion requirement does not exist. I haven't really heard anything beyond, I think everything that I've said addresses what Ms. Hine has said. And I think that my briefing is clear on the subject.
Yeah,
and it sounds like
question.
The court has a, you do have a question.
The statement under, Miranda rights, or which you say was clearly only directed at the right to counsel. What it actually says is, I'm invoking my Fifth Amendment right and my due process right to counsel, right?
Yeah, I think that's what it
says. So how do we know that that's only the right to counsel? Usually when you talk about the Fifth Amendment, colloquially, it's, I'm not going to answer any questions.
I think that the conjunctive matters. The Fifth Amendment and due process right to counsel. When he says,
that's one way to read it, and the other way to read it is the Fifth Amendment and the due process right to counsel.
Yeah, I think that certainly is a fair way to parse it. But then when he continues to talk about repeatedly what the facts are, I asked for an attorney. They said none was available. I again asked for an attorney at the interrogation. Never does he say,
but again,
I asked
what the right to counsel is, the right to not speak without a lawyer. So this dichotomy, this clear dichotomy that you're trying to draw doesn't work very well, does it? I mean, if I say I don't want to speak, why not? Because I don't have a lawyer. That is a perfectly sensible statement, right?
Yes, I agree with that.
And so without the because, it's still a statement that could be intertwined with the right to counsel, no?
You're correct that they are intertwined, but then analytically they're treated differently. I don't know why the United States Supreme Court, and I think it was Michigan v. Mosley, said that they're different, that they're different rights. That I don't understand necessarily why they're treated differently in terms of, okay, well, you've asked for an attorney, you can never be asked any questions
ultimately,
again.
Ultimately, when the argument was made that they should be treated differently for purposes of the degree of ambiguity, the Supreme Court said, oh, no, they're the same for that purpose, for that legal purpose.
And that may be true in that sense, but when you have a case here where he's very clear as to what it is he's asking for, and he's narrowing the focus of all of the courts, not just the state courts, but even the federal courts, including this court on appeal, when the focus is as narrow as it is, that cabins the issue. And that's what we're dealing with here. And that's what makes this an unfair case to the state, where this has been so cabined, not by us, but by the petitioner himself and by the federal public defender representing him on appeal the first time around. That when it gets that cabined, and then all of a sudden we get a relief granted on a claim that none of us had ever thought about, none of us had ever addressed.
Well, it was argued before us, so I don't know how you can say nobody ever heard of it. And the last argument that we had in this court, there were at least three sentences dealing with the right to silence.
With no legal art, with no analysis, with no development, with nothing beyond just passing references. I think that that's not enough to really bring an issue to the fore, especially when you're dealing with an attorney that's bringing it before the court. And a drive-by citation by an attorney without any legal analysis isn't really much of a citation of legal authority at all. So I've made my point clear. The court understands what this case is all about.
Well, and thank you both very much. It was nice to see you again. And we hope that we're not going to see you a third time. Anyway,
thank you, Your Honor.
The case is submitted and we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor.